DW Deutsche Welle. World Link.
Hello and welcome to DW's World Link, bringing you the personal stories behind the headlines. In Bonn, Germany, I'm Gabriel Borud. On this week's show, we're going to take a look back at past World Link reports that show different ways that artists see our world, starting with a street photographer in Yemen who's had enough of documenting just devastation.
It has great culture, it has great history, kind people, and people need to know about that, because if we're talking about mutual understanding and creating an international understanding in the world, but how are we going to create that if there is no positive media?
We'll also introduce you to a German philosophizing poet and meet the Korean cartoonist using art to poke fun at his country's office culture. All that and much, much more coming up on World Link. You're listening to DW's World Link with me, Gabriel Borud. For years now, Yemen has been overwhelmed by war. If you follow the situation from abroad, the headlines and pictures coming from the capital, Sana'a, would suggest that everyday life there is all but insufferable. But that devastation is exactly what Tana Farouk does not want to portray with her pictures. The street photographer, who is in her mid-20s, wants to show that life in Sana'a is bright, vibrant, and even happy. My colleague Samantha Early caught up with Tana to talk about her work.
The thing is, think about it. When you meet somebody from Yemen in the street, in Germany or in the US or anywhere else, what do you think of Yemen? Like, you think about the killings, the people who fight each other all the time. You hear about the war, you hear about terrorism. But Yemen is beyond that. Yemen is more. It has great culture, it has great history, kind people, and people need to know about that, because if we're talking about mutual understanding and creating an international understanding in the world, but how are we going to create that if there is no positive media nowadays? And I felt I don't want to document, you know, the ugly stuff. I want to document not necessarily the happy moments, but the reality. And reality has the bad and good. So I wanted to document also, I want to show the good side of Yemen. So I wanted, like, me, even during the war, I didn't want to document the war, like the ugly things. I wanted to document people's resilience and their ways to cope with the situation. It's a very important for the audience here or anywhere else to know about that. So that was very important for me, to show the details that you don't necessarily get to know unless you come to Yemen. But since you are not in Yemen, I want to be your window. When you go to my website or my blog, Everyday Yemen, I want that to be as a window. This is Yemen. This is that. Oh, this is... I just want to put things and give you more perspective and let people think about Yemen and be an ambassador for my country whenever I go. I'm not saying it's easy, because, like, being a woman, a street photographer in Yemen has never been easy. But
yeah. Tell me a bit about that. Yeah. You discovered this in Boston,
yeah.
A very different environment. Yeah, how do you go about that? Yeah.
Well, the first time, you have no idea. I had this fear and it was literally shivering the first few days. I can't do it. People look at me. But I realized, I mean, whenever I'm with my camera, I am on a mission. I'm not just there taking photos. I'm there to document reality. And I felt empowered with it. And day by day, I felt I'm not afraid anymore, because who says we can do art? Who says we can do photography? I want to prove that as a woman, as a young woman in Yemen, I can do art, I can be a street photographer, and I can be an example for many girls like me who want to pursue it as a professional career. And that's why I wanted to try to do it.
How freely then, though, are you able to move about and take your photos?
Yeah. It was much easier before the war in Yemen. It was like, you know, I did not have to fear the airstrikes, for example. But now it becomes way harder, because I want to document reality. I don't want to be hidden in my room. You know, as a human being, I was afraid to lose my life. So, and that really, like, I felt very depressed the first few weeks. I can't go out. I'm locked in my room. We can't even, sometimes, like, even going to supermarket becomes very difficult. And I felt this is not the life I wanted. You know, it was really hard. But then this is where actually I started Everyday Yemen. I felt I want to be free, and if that would take in me going to the streets even during the war, I will do it. So I started this blog, Everyday Yemen, to show the everyday life during the war. That, yes, we have this war, we have this violence going on, but we're determined to keep going.
You've also shared some insights into that from your own life. For example, I saw a picture you posted of a novel and a box of chocolates, which you described as the best weapon against warplanes.
Yes, yes. For me, it's more about the little details in life. So for me, it's about the Nutella. It's about watching a good series. It's about watching Game of Thrones, you know? So as long as I enjoy these things while they last for me, then I'm going to keep enjoying them. I love chocolate. Then for me, it's a happiness, you know? Like, when you're depressed, when you have no option, you're almost losing hope, you start to look to the things around you. And just me sitting, drinking my green tea and chocolate, that's a happiness in itself. Because I feel I'm still alive, I'm still here, I'm still exist. So it matters to me a lot.
How do the people respond to you approaching them on the street? And has that changed over the years?
I love that. First of all, I mean, you get these funny comments. What are you doing in the street? Are you married? Where's your husband? How? And all these funny jokes and comments around. But then I felt, that's the thing I noticed about people in Yemen. They are not used to be photographed. You know, they are not used like to have a woman in the street taking their photos. So it's a new thing for them, and I understand that. But actually, the more I do it, the more I feel like people are accepting. I mean, you could approach them, they will be intimidated in the beginning, but then they will start to respond with you. And then, like, once they get comfortable with you, they'll tell you everything about them. And you also will be more comfortable taking their pictures. So for me, it's about breaking barriers. I'm not, like, I don't want to be stuck not doing it. I want to try. I think people have been enjoying the photos, and they got to see that Yemen is not, even the local people, Yemen is not just about violence. It's about, you know, hope. And people needs, like, the Yemeni people needs hope more than anything else now. So I'm glad that I was able to deliver this hope for them.
And is that also a perspective that you can bring, having grown up there? I mean, you studied overseas, right?
Yeah.
But you were born in, where were you born?
I was born and raised in Yemen. And then when I was 16, I went to Canada, where I studied the International Baccalaureate, you know, IB, which is equivalent to grade 11, 12. And then I got another scholarship to study bachelor degree. Yes. And then I came back. I decided to come back in Yemen in 2013.
Yeah, well, why did you decide to come back? What brought you back?
Okay. So I thought about it. In Boston, I could attend lots of photography classes. I could attend a lot of exhibitions. And to be honest, there are a lot of opportunities for me to grow as an artist. But there are so many, like, Boston doesn't need me, you know. America doesn't need me as a photographer. I'd rather be at home and really make a difference there. I was lucky to give in these scholarships because they thought, you know, I would do something with them later on. So I decided to go back because it's worth it to go back. It's worth it to take pictures. It's worth telling stories. So I never regret it personally.
So you're based in Sana'a, but you've traveled also on assignment to rural areas recently. Can you give me an example of what stood out to you about the different challenges that they're facing in other parts of the country?
I live in the capital, but I work with different NGOs in Yemen, including CARE International, Oxfam, British Council, and some magazines. And part of what we do is we cover the humanitarian situations. For example, the situation of IDPs around the country. And it was my first time actually traveling around Yemen and covering IDPs camps. And it was, never thought I'm going to be so emotional about it. I thought, you know, losing lives and having to move out of your comfort zone and leave your house behind is never an easy thing. It was really hard for me actually to see, like, you know, children who lost their family or women speaking to me saying, well, we used to have beautiful homes. I mean, they were not, you know, luxury or fancy houses, but it's our houses. We want to go back. That was really hard to hear. And I felt more determined, actually, to tell their stories and dig deep into their lives. And, you know, I hate to say that, but Yemen is completely dropped off the international agenda. And it's almost unforgotten. But people, I wanted to raise awareness and educate the world that there is something going on in Yemen. And your support is needed, you know, feeling at least, you know, thinking about the people there, trying to search about them. That's important as well. So, yeah.
Yeah. What does it mean for you to, you know, that international people do see your work and do appreciate it? all sides of what's going on in Yemen, because you're right, I mean, it doesn't get the coverage here that, you know, the scale of the tragedy deserves.
Yes, you're right, and it's a very sad thing, but it's also part of education. Not so many, there are a lot of activists, but the tools are limited. We have the social media exist, but when it comes to the basic necessities like electricity, we have not had electricity for a year now since the war started. You're talking about reporting, but what if you don't have the means to report? I mean, you don't have electricity, you don't have internet. So people, we exist, but we sometimes cannot, you know, carry and transfer this message to people. So for me, it's very important to carry this message. It's very important for people around the world. I believe in humanity, and I believe, and I still have faith in humanity. And that's why I feel the message needs to be carried around and educate the world about it.
Thana Farouk, street photographer and visual storyteller in Yemen, thank you so much for speaking with me on DW's WorldLink.
Thank you so much. It was my great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Using images to tell stories. This is the ethos that has guided Gert Ludwig, one of Germany's most regarded photojournalists throughout his career. Ludwig has shot around the globe, but he is best known for his work documenting the upheaval in the dwindling Soviet Union and the post-apocalyptic setting in Chernobyl after the nuclear disaster in 1989. Ludwig's life revolves around his pictures, and our reporter, Lena Nozizwa, caught up with him in Los Angeles to talk about photography and life.
The earliest and most powerful imagery in photojournalist Gerd Ludwig's life has nothing to do with a camera. Instead, it was his father's voice. He remembers at the age of 4 listening to his father's memories of war in a small room in a small village near Frankfurt, Germany.
At night, I would listen to the sad and soothing voice of my father as he conjured images of people fighting and of other people hiding from soldiers in stables and barns. I didn't know what my father was talking about. I considered his stories bedtime stories. Only later I realized that the people fighting were German soldiers. The people hiding from them in stables and barns were Russians filled with fear. And that my father was trying to shed his terrible memories of war this way.
His father, Robert, was a soldier in Germany's 6th Army that invaded the Soviet Union in 1942. He fought through to Ukraine and into Stalingrad, where Russian forces ultimately struck back. Ludwig says his father was among the last soldiers to be evacuated.
I asked my father later, Dad, why did you fight there? You know, he never said a single bad word about Russians. So I asked him, why did you fight there? And his answer, it was war, my son, wasn't good enough.
His father's recollections would later impact the images that would fill his viewfinder, and they would frame his point of view.
I grew up as this typical post-war German, filled with guilt for my parents' deeds. And subsequently, I started to idolize and idealize everything that my parents' generation had tried to destroy: Israel and the Soviet Union.
Guilt would be superimposed over his photography, an area of interest that started to develop when he was a teenager, although he says he never imagined that photography would turn into a career. So when it was time to go to college, he majored in political science, along with physical education and German literature. But he says he switched to photography when he realized its power after reading an impactful magazine article. He contemplated becoming a high school photography teacher in Germany. But after college in 1979, he got an assignment that would take him back to the original scene of his childhood memories. It was for the publication GEO, the German equivalent of National Geographic.
But during those days, I didn't allow myself to make critical pictures of a nation that had suffered from my parents' generation's deeds for such a long time. So while my first images there were a really depiction of the Russian soul, they lacked social and economic context. They ignored the social and economic realities of a country that had been under Soviet rule for 70 years.
He would return more than 30 times to a place that he was introduced to via his father's macabre bedtime stories.
When I first then went to Russia, I saw pictures of my childhood. I saw a country that I knew. My father had described it in his nightly stories. So I was drawn to that country. And at the same time, I think I'm still working off my German guilt by trying to understand Russia, trying to understand and respect that nation.
More international assignments followed, including shooting for the Day in the Life book franchise. In the 1980s, Ludwig relocated to the United States, where he was approached by the holy grail of photojournalists, National Geographic.
A lot of people will ask, how do you become a National Geographic photographer? They call you, you don't call them. And then I presented my work there and started to work for them. And the rest is history. I've worked for them since the late 1980s.
He has become well known for his photographic studies of countries that were once part of the former Soviet Union. On April 26, 1986, an accident led to what's considered the worst nuclear power plant disaster in history at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine.
I had the chance to go to Chernobyl in 1993, and I really became hooked. I returned over and over again. I was deeper inside the Chernobyl reactor than any Western still photographer.
Going deep inside the reactor required the help of an engineer guide.
So it took him a long time to open the jammed door. The adrenaline surge, of course, was incredible. The room was absolutely dark, lit only by our headlamps at the time. Wires were obstructing my view. At the end of the room, I could make out a clock. I was only able to shoot off a few strobes and wanted to wait for my flash to recharge. But at that point, the engineer already pulled me back by my shoulders. I checked my pictures outside, but they were all out of focus. I begged him to go in one more time. He gave me a few more seconds to frame the clock, which is showing 1:23 a.m., the time when on April 26, 1986, the building that housed the block number 4 when there. Time stood still forever. The clock froze in that very moment.
Ludwig has been able to freeze time at Chernobyl several times since then, with repeat visits in 2011 and 2013, images that are all encapsulated in his book, The Long Shadow of Chernobyl. It features an essay by Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the president of the Soviet Union when the disaster occurred. Last year, the book won the Photo Book of the Year Award from Picture of the Year International, just one of many accolades Ludwig has received during his career as a photojournalist. Other honors include the Lucy Award for International Photographer of the Year and the Honor Medal for Distinguished Service in Journalism from the Missouri School of Journalism.
From the original master.
His celebrity as a photographer even led him to star in a beer commercial.
And here's my photograph of the taste of Pilsner Urquell.
After all these years, the drive to capture images and share what he has learned has not faded. The man who once considered becoming a high school teacher now teaches photo workshops around the world, from China to Italy. At age 69, in an era when photography seems less about the decisive moment and more about selfies, he's intrigued by all of it, from Instagram to Facebook, and he says he's still learning, at times, from his students. And he keeps moving. When we spoke at his Los Angeles studio, he had just come back from a 10-week assignment for National Geographic in Russia. But his latest personal project is closer to home.
I very rarely dealt with subjects in my hometown. And after having lived in Los Angeles for such a long time, I saw these cars, these creatures. They became to me like the blood in the veins of Los Angeles. And a visiting writer said to me, "I wonder where these cars all go to sleep at night." And that sentence stuck with me for a long, long time. So I started to cruise Los Angeles at night, and I saw these cars tucked away in driveways, covered by tarps. Their owners treated them like crated pets. Some of them sleep in their nightgowns. Some of them sleep very lightly covered. Others sleep in the nude. And a few lucky ones get to sleep together. The cars became my way of dealing with Los Angeles. But also I realized that as I get older and as everybody photographs or snaps pictures of everything, I became more interested not so much in the action itself, but I became interested in the results of people's actions and how people park their car, how they tuck in their car, to me became interesting and storytelling in a different way. At the same time, I went back to Chernobyl and I started to photograph the still lives that the people created in Chernobyl. They started to rearrange the gas masks and the dolls that they found there into their own still lives, and they left them sitting there. So I became very interested in these creations of still lives that humans do as a way of telling a story about their state of mind.
Ludwig's life is hardly still. It took me months to arrange for an interview. He was either on an international assignment or teaching a workshop. That's intentional.
I'm curious. I wish I had another 30 years to actively photograph. You know, my ideal point of death, at some point, somebody asked me, how do you think you would love to die? I said, I would love to die with a camera in my hand, having had a heart attack because the picture was so beautiful. But please, when I'm 100 years old.
DW, Deutsche Welle.
And I'm Gabriel Borud in Bonn. You're listening to WorldLink. You're listening to DW's WorldLink with me, Gabriel Borud. Coming up in the next half hour, ever thought you've had the stuff to become a successful writer? We'll hear what it takes from German poet Julia Trumpeter. We'll also find out how to make possibly the best cup of coffee in the world from a master brewer. And we're going to meet the South Korean who uses cartoons to make fun of his country's office culture. For those stories and more, please stay tuned to WorldLink. Creating art for a living is a luxury afforded only very few in our world. It follows that competition among painters, poets, and composers of all kinds is very high. How am I going to make my living? This is a question posed by every burgeoning young artist, including the ones whose work is by nature esoteric. Julia Trumpeter is a 36-year-old German poet, and I met up with her in Cologne to talk about these things and about what's really in her poems.
A shaft of sunlight breaks through the shut lids of O. Marquee extending. Oh 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 Meanwhile, it's cloudy again.
That was the end of the poem, right?
Yes.
So so what was that one called?
The Marquis of O, of course.
The Marquis of O, of course!
When I read this poem to my grandmother, she said, yeah, so we had such a marquee in our old house, and it was a marquee that you had to extend by hand. So it's a hard work just to extend such a marquee.
And was it hard work to create this poem? Or was it just a bit of fun?
I would say this was one of the poems that was a bit of fun more. Of course, it's a game with words, it's a game with tunes, so it's fun to read it. People always are amused when I read it. That's why I like it very much.
Zur Lage 1. Ohne das Konsumverhalten deiner Augen, die mich ansehen wie so ein Zettel voll mit Dingen, die erledigt werden wollen.
When I first met Julia Trompeter, it was at a public reading from her collection of poems called Zum Begreifen nah, or Easy to Grasp in English. She is not your typical 35-year-old German. She's involved in a philosophy PhD program, studying and teaching the ancient Greeks, and in her free time, she writes poetry. In our utterly utilitarian and hedonistic 21st century society, Julia chose a path in the humanities because there was no other choice for her, she says. Still, she calls herself privileged, especially when she considers some of the struggles that her fellow poets go through on a day-to-day basis.
So I didn't need to earn money with my art. And that's, I mean, with privileged situation, because colleagues of mine are, so I see them really struggling. So they don't know how to make their living and how to live from writing poetry.
Do you look forward to that challenge of having to survive off of your art?
Yes, in a way, I fear that because I'm not that free with doing what I'm doing, because I always have to think about who could buy that and is that something that will be sold well or not. So that's the bigger problem. It's hard to be free and to write what you want to write, because there's the danger that you change your writing because you think about selling. So, and that's what I do not want.
Once loved a girl, her skin it was bronze. With the innocence of a lamb, she was gentle like a fawn. I courted her proudly, but now she's gone. Gone as the season she's taken.
Easy to grasp. In German, it's Zum Begreifen nah, and this is the title of my book. Gushing, he kicked in the door. Thereby, a wind got up inside. Almost a hurricane, which shattered something. And afterwards, lathed as it were for years, when only just the soul had been at ease again, the room sank down into a silence after storm. From this day on, each anniversary, someone steps in, and on the jukebox she plays Riders on the Storm, and follows with her eyes the startled eddy from fine dust, which afterwards, when back in memory, settles on the bar in its old shape again, and on the chairs. And all the genies in all bottles fall asleep again. And someone did expire all the year, 500 times alone, and saw the things that happened in the past, and felt another hand just as if it were here.
Riders on the Storm. Riders on the Storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone, an actor out alone. Riders on the Storm. There's a killer on the road.
Again?
Easy to grasp. No, you don't have to read it again. That was very easy to grasp. I got it right away.
Are you sure?
Okay, so that's a moment then. Or is this one memory that you're processing? Or is this an idea, a feeling, a sense perception? Where are you gathering the substance of this poem from?
Mm-hmm. In a way, it's all of that, what you suggested, but I think this is mostly about memory or remembering, because it's the situation of someone who thinks about another person, a person who's far away, who's not there, and the...
Who were you thinking about, if you don't mind me asking?
So,
or is that too personal?
Of course it's personal, but I think I was not thinking about someone special here in particular. It's more a general feeling, I think, most people have in their life once or twice or more times.
Is it like a loneliness or a nostalgia? Or?
Yeah, it's a kind of Sehnsucht.
Passion.
Yeah.
Or some kind of longing.
Longing, yearning, that's better, yeah.
For what?
If you miss someone and you want him or her to be near, but the person is not there, so then you have no chance. So sometimes you can do something, but sometimes you cannot do anything. So if the people is dead, for instance, or if he or she does not want to have contact with you or is very far away, then there's no way to get a real connection. And then I think one tries to find other ways to get in contact. And writing a poem about this special feeling of longing and missing someone, writing a poem about this is one way to get in touch with another person, or maybe with oneself, in a way.
Getting in touch with others, both in the metaphysical and physical sense, is at the heart of poetry, as difficult as this may seem at times. At Yulia's reading, I asked two guys who showed up at a whim what they thought of her poems.
I think I need more time to think about the poems, because poems aren't art that can be dealt with in a short time.
What about you?
Actually, I came here because we both were watching football last evening, and he told me I was thinking about if I should watch football today too, and he told me about this here tonight.
Would you have rather watched football tonight?
No. Simply no, because this is at first hard to understand, and it's hard to follow, because after one poem you need very much time to think about it and to get the point of it. But I think there's so much in these poems that it's very interesting, and much more interesting than watching football.
One of the guys I talked to at your reading last week said he was actually happy that he came and listened, even though he wanted to watch a football game or a soccer game. You've got a poem here about soccer, is that right?
I mean, soccer plays a role in it, let's say it like that.
All right, let's hear it.
Some thoughts in March. Looks in a sunny mood through the salt-encrusted pane. Pale-mouthed it looks early this year into the living room at the antenna's end. Glass picture show, parallel greenhouse thoughts. VTR, sparrow, march, murder, word, phrase. You're looking at what? Corner, Leverkusen, header, Berbatov. Missed.
DW, Deutsche Welle.
If you're like me, the chances are extremely high that you've had one today. And probably right after you got out of bed. A cup of coffee. But was it good coffee? What does that really even mean? And how do you make the perfect cup? Well, if anyone knows, it should be Hannes Fendrich, a professional roaster and one of Germany's leading coffee connoisseurs. DW reporter Theresa Krinninger met the man with the science behind the beans and sends us this report from Berlin.
We're in the courtyard of an old factory brick building in Wedding, a multicultural hub in Berlin. The smell of freshly roasted coffee is in the air. Inside the roastery, I'm standing in front of a pile of coffee bags 10 meters long.
What are you doing there, actually?
Now we're just going to fill up some green beans.
This was Patrick Rolf, the assistant of master roaster Hannes.
So we're making sure that it's basically just making sure that we have the right amount of coffee in the machine when we're roasting. So we're pre-filling everything here into what we call a loader, and then we lift up the coffee on top of the machine.
And you're the roaster here too?
Nah, I'm just basically just helping Hannes to start.
31-year-old Hannes is in charge here. His glasses give him a nerdy but very friendly look. He takes a handful of green beans and shows them to me.
This is green coffee or raw coffee, as some people call it. It's green because the color is green. Coffee is the seedling of a coffee cherry. And in every coffee cherry, we have two seedlings. And coffee is produced around the coffee belt, close to the equator, all over the world. And we mainly have Ethiopian coffees here, and always 60 kilos are in one bag.
We're upstairs in the office now, and of course there's a long counter for making coffee. Hannes shows me his recipe for what's probably the best coffee in the world, according to him. He starts by weighing 15 grams of beans per quarter liter of water. Too much?
Slightly, okay. Good.
So, what do I need to make that at home?
You need good coffee, of course. And then you need water, which shouldn't be too hard. So in Berlin, we have very hard water. That's why I'm using some filtrated water here, which is a little softer. Then I have a pour-over kit, which is called Hario V60. And I think that gives you a very clean and transparent coffee taste. That's why I like it and use it a lot. That's it already.
Not only Hannes is obsessed and even nerdy about coffee, more and more Germans are investing time and money for better tasting coffee. Hannes has noticed two trends in the past couple of years.
We have one that people are paying more attention where the bean comes from, like the whole slow food movement, and they're willing to pay more for politically correct coffee or fair trade coffee. So this is one trend that we have. And then we have as other trend also the flavor trend or whatever you can call it, so that people pay more attention towards the flavors of the coffee, that a coffee from one country, from Colombia, tastes different to Ethiopia and whatsoever.
He says it is mainly a trend among young people. It is more difficult to convince older people to drink this kind of lighter roasted coffee. They have been drinking their coffee with milk and sugar for 20 or 30 years. But he observed something else, the renaissance of the filter coffee, as he calls it.
So the people take out their old milliliter filter and they really celebrate drinking coffee much more now as a contra trend towards the capsules, I would also say. And for them, it's also interesting to discover the nicer coffee beans, but they don't necessarily drink lighter roasted beans.
Well, I have to say, after this inspiring crash course, I feel like going home, putting away my old mocha can, and get right into brewing a nice cup myself. But is it really worth it, putting so much effort in one single cup of coffee?
Well, I'm not saying you have to, but for me, it's super fun to invest so much time in coffee, because then my coffee tastes better and I'm happy for the day. But if you don't want to, then I can understand that. And there's other way to drink your coffee, but everyone has to find his best option.
Cheers.
Teresa Grinninger, DW, Berlin.
We're going to move quickly now to Peru. And just as Hannes Fendrich is a master at brewing coffee, Peruvian chef Virgilio Martinez is an expert at making new cuisine from ancient cultural recipes. His restaurant, Central, is ranked number one in all of Latin America and number four in the world. But what's really important to him and his sister Malena is their work with local communities as they traverse Peru. Jane Chambers went to meet them in Lima.
We are at Central Restaurante in Lima, Peru.
With lots of activity going on, we're actually in the kitchen. The chefs are preparing. There are many pots, stirring going on. What's on the menu here?
We prepare menus based on different ecosystems and different altitudes of Peru. And yeah, we have a huge team. And yeah, we're just about to get ready for tonight's service.
Before I try the 16-course tasting menu showcasing their finds, I want to find out more about Mata Initiative, the research organization that Virgilio and his sister Malena founded.
The objective of Mater Iniciativa was to register Peruvian indigenous ingredients in their origin. So we got to travel a lot around Peru to register these ingredients.
And what made you want to do that?
You know, when you're in Peru and you get to understand that in order to get to the ingredients, the actual ingredients, you have to understand the way of living of the people that is connected to those ingredients and our agricultural heritage and the knowledge that these Andean people have gathered through ages.
Now, sadly, you're not doing any trips for me to go on at the moment. We're at your office in Lima, but it's very special. All around me, we've got samples of different things. So what would be great is if we can just go and have a look at some of these things find out the stories behind them.
Well, the main thing here right now is that we are doing this collection of plants that are endemic from two different areas of the Andes of Peru.
When you say endemic, so they're native?
Yes, exactly. They are native and they are plants that are either wild plants or domesticated. So the thing is, each one of these samples that you can see here are have a medicinal purpose or are used in cooking. For instance, we have retamas right here. These are beautiful yellow flowers that are used as anti-inflammatory, so they make an infusion of them.
Milena and her team work very closely with the local producers, often communicating with them through translators, because their native language is Quechua, not Spanish.
When we go there, we don't go as interventionists. We go there to learn. And they understand that and they see that with good eyes. They receive that and then they ask for recipes, for instance, which is great for us because that's something that we can really give them.
So what kind of recipes have you given them?
I remember this one time because they showed us a wide variety of herbs and coloring things, natural coloring things, and there had a lot of vegetables. And so Virgilio just made a soup with all these aromatic herbs. And some of them, they were using these herbs only as medicine, so they were kind of not trusting it was going to be a good result. But at the end, they got to try it, and they really liked it, which was really nice.
Some people would say that it's the kind of new trendy thing to seek out natural native ingredients, but there can be a downside to this, can't there? I mean, people talk about quinoa and how that's become so popular in the West that local people can't eat it. So how can you help with that?
We as a restaurant have the responsibility to communicate very well with these communities and listen to what they want, because if we thought it was about producing more and because we want to buy them more, then we are not listening very well, because it's not about that for them. You know, sometimes they just want their things to be appreciated. In the last few years, there was this big explosion of quinoa. At the end of the day, it wasn't as good for the farmers because the demand was so high, they were not able to cover that. At the end, it wasn't beneficial for them. It was beneficial for the big industries, but not for the farmers.
So how can you manage that? Because you have your restaurant here showcasing local ingredients, and if one becomes really popular and lots of people want to get it, how can you manage that if it becomes a threat to that ingredient becoming extinct?
What we have found out is that it's better to get connected with associations of producers so that they can see how something can work and they can make it work as an association. And because in the Andes it's very common that they get to gather and make a corporation, you know, let's say, of farmers, for instance, and they get to organize and they get to produce more if they wanted to. We really wanna get involved in the whole process with them.
Downstairs in the busy restaurant, Virgilio explains how the tasting menu works.
At one point we wanted to do a tasting menu, of course, but we thought, why not thinking about altitudes? Peru is full of altitudes and different ecosystems. So we have chosen 16 altitudes, and these 16 altitudes are going to give you 16 ecosystems. Every single dish that is gonna come will represent one place, one landscape, and yeah, you're gonna go like from the sea to the desert coast to the valleys, then to the Andes, to the high peaks in the Andes, and then to the jungle, to the Amazon.
So what have you got from the Amazon?
You know, we're working a lot with plants from the Amazon, even with the natural dyes, lots of colors from the Amazon, from the fruits. Lots of fruits, one fish from the Amazon called paiche, and then a few vegetables coming from the jungle.
Time to taste the food.
Okay, the next one, the jungle is kale, over the leaf, jungle crab with sangre de grado, it's a resin from a tree, and gamitana. It's a kind of fish. Enjoy it.
I just love the presentation on these. It's amazing. It's like getting a slice of nature every time a dish comes towards you. You have to eat with your fingers. To be honest, sometimes I get a bit confused about what I should be eating and what I shouldn't be eating. But it is very, very beautiful. And this is a jungle one. So we've got bits of jungle leaves and twigs, poking them some rocks. And then in a very delicate leaf that I'm assuming I can eat, what our lovely waiter just described, and some beautiful pink flowers. I'm on plate number 12 now. It is absolutely delicious, but it's quite something working your way through 16 different tastes from all the different altitudes. I don't think I'm going to actually be able to eat for a month after this, however delicious it is. Final one.
Yes, the final one. So, the over-the-frozen cacao, 72% with the mucilage of the cacao. The little cake is covered by flowers. And in the glass, cedron. The cedron is a kind of mint. And the infusion is made with congona. It's a medicinal herb. If you want, start with the cacao and the flowers. And in the final drink, the infusion. Enjoy it.
Thank you very much. Well, that really was an education, I have to say. I've eaten everything from tiny little potato tubers, which are obviously very important here in Peru, to edible clay, to resin from bark, to different kind of corn and quinoa. It is a really brilliant way of showcasing all the food that they collect from the different regions in Peru, and just showing quite how much variety there is in this country. It certainly isn't just about ceviche, and it's very easy to understand why Peru's enjoying such a boom, a culinary boom.
And finally this week, we're going to take you to the office, the most dreaded place for many a worker around the world on a Monday morning, especially in South Korea, which tops global rankings for the longest daily work hours. But artist Yang Kyung-soo is giving workers something to laugh about at their jobs. He pokes fun at his country's office culture with his satirical cartoon series that's taken off on social media. Jason Strother in Seoul has the story.
For millions of South Koreans, the morning subway ride to the office begins a very long day at work. Most will be expected to stay at their jobs until late at night or whenever their bosses say it's time to go home.
틀에 박혀서 이렇게 몇 시에 출근해서 몇 시에 퇴근하고 이런 기계처럼 살아가는.
You also have to follow your boss's orders without exception. I don't think office workers have any freedom to express their own opinions at their jobs.
그려보려고 노력하고 있습니다.
That's 32-year-old artist Yang Kyung-soo. He says Korean office culture is a mix of top-down Confucianism as well as military hierarchy. And that's the subject of his popular single-frame illustration series called Yakchigi, which roughly means pesticide. An authoritarian, passive-aggressive, or even pervy boss is a figure that many office workers here have to deal with, the artist says, or at least so he's heard about.
시작을 한 거는
I've never worked in an office myself, but I have a lot of friends who do. The only time they can open up about how they feel is after work when they are drinking. I ask them why they can't give their opinions to their bosses, but they tell me it's impossible.
In Yakjigi, Yang gives his office worker characters the power to say things their real-life counterparts could never get away with. Here's an example. In one illustration, a boss approaches his employee while holding a big bag with the word "feeling rewarded" written on it. The employee says,
"You've got to be kidding me."
And thinks,
"I don't care about feeling rewarded. Just pay me overtime."
Here's another. A boss leans over a desk and touches the arm of a young female employee. Captions over their heads read,
"You remind me of my daughter."
"But you only have two sons."
I wanted to talk about Yakjigi with some people who actually work in Korean offices. I met up with three office workers during their coffee break. They don't want me to use their names, but they are all big fans of the cartoon series.
The author shouts out to the society what I couldn't have said to my boss. Or yes, he sympathizes with all the workers in the office. It also kind of reminds me that I'm not the one, only one who's suffering these. I don't know, that's really what's good about his cartoon.
The most senior member of the group says Yakjigi reminds her of what she shouldn't do.
I don't want to make my junior staff feel that kind of feelings, you know.
She turns to her coworkers.
But I don't know, am I doing okay?
Is she a good sunbae, a good senior here?
Yeah, sure, Vita.
Probably
she's good.
You can't say no here. That's the culture we have. Yeah.
Do you think it's becoming more liberal?
Popularity of these comics, one of the signals of the culture of a Korean office become more liberal. Because before that, we don't even talk about this stuff.
Despite the rigors of office life here, artist Yang Kyung-soo says most Koreans are still drawn to these types of jobs because of their financial stability. Not doing so can also cause a rift within families, like it did to his. His parents are also artists, but work on commission. Yang says the path he chose wasn't acceptable to them.
They couldn't understand why I wanted to study fine arts. They knew it would be hard for me to make money. It created a big conflict with them. We haven't spoken for the past 10 years. I doubt they even know about how my career has gone.
A book featuring Yang's Yakjigi drawings was recently published, and he plans to expand the series to include other occupations too. But he says he's not giving up on his first artistic passion, making Buddhist-inspired paintings. Yang says he doesn't see any contradiction between making that type of art and making cartoons about Korean office culture.
They give me balance in my life. They balance all the characters inside me. Buddhist art is hard work. It requires lots of research. Making Yakjigi reminds me of my childhood, doodling in the classroom. Maybe one is serious and the other isn't, but they are both a part of me.
Yang says perhaps it's Buddhism that makes him ask whether he's living to work or working to live. For DW, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
And that's all we have time for this week. We hope you enjoyed our special World Link Turn Back the Clock. You can always find the program or any individual reports at dw.com/worldlink, SoundCloud, or iTunes. You can also find parts of the show and plenty of other interesting material on our Global Society Facebook page. World Link was produced by me, Gabriel Borud. Our sound engineer was Jürgen Kuhn. World Link was brought to you by DW in Bonn, Germany.